He couldn't help but worry that his nephew would do further damage to his knee, even though the brace did provide good protection. He saw the emotional effect the injury was having on Booby, the prolonged periods of depression as one Friday night after another just came and went. "He wants to have that magic wand and have it like it was before his knee got hurt," LV said, but he knew that wasn't possible. He wondered if he was doing the right thing by letting Booby play at all. He had always risen to protect Booby and somehow make life right for him. He had fought for him and with him, and whenever Booby had veered off course, he successfully put him back on it. Early in the season, before everything had turned so hideous, LV had stood in the failing afternoon light and silently watched Booby perform. The other boosters and parents and hangers-on traveled from one end of the practice field to the other in friendly little packs. But LV stayed off by himself, as if he felt he didn't quite belong. Instead, his eyes just followed as Booby danced and weaved and did all those things on the beautifully manicured, well-watered fields that LV had patiently taught him. He didn't have the look of a proud, gaping parent, but the look of someone always there for Booby, always keeping an eye out for him. It had seemed so simple then. But now, every option was fraught with painful uncertainty. Should he let Booby play, even if it meant the risk of further injury, because it was the only way he could still contend for a major college scholarship? Or should he put the dream in jeopardy and elect to have the surgery done on Booby now, before it was too late, before there was more physical and psychological damage?
"High school is important, but this is a stepping stone," said LV one day, sitting on a bench in the locker room of the field house, surrounded by all the little pictures on the wall of fame. "If he gets hurt here," the thought made him shudder. Back home in a worn envelope were the letters from Texas A&M and Nebraska and Oklahoma and all the rest that had glowed as powerfully as kryptonite. In his heart, he believed the recruiters wouldn't run from his nephew just because of a knee injury. With a little time, he'd be as good as new. But the Permian staff said there was no way a major college would touch Booby now, unless he came back and proved that he had recovered. He was damaged goods, like a crate of Florida oranges that had gone rotten in delivery, and the big boys were not going to deal with him unless they had positive proof some sweet juice could still be squeezed out of him, not some mess of pulp and seeds. Privately, the Permian staff, with the exception of Coach Hearn, didn't see any dilemma in Booby's decision at all. The doctor had cleared him to play, which in the coach's minds meant he could play. And all the things that went along with the injury, the mental aspect of having to adjust to being a white shirt substitute, the necessity of major knee surgery after the season, whether he gained 1 yard or 1,000, the fluid that had to be drawn from it, the fear of getting hit on it, were necessary prices to pay. Others had done it. He wasn't the first. To a large degree, they saw him as selfish and undisciplined and utterly undedicated to the great cause of Mojo.
"Playing to him is not what it's all about," said Trapper. "He just doesn't want to play. Fuckheads can just play. He wants to be number one. He wants to be the one with his name in the paper. He wants to be the leading rusher in District 4, 5A. He wants to be the one they're talking about." "I think he can come back. It's a mental block. He's blinded himself. His attitude is, if I can't be the center of attention, I don't want to be anything at all." "He's not just letting himself down. He's letting the team down. He's letting Gaines down. He's letting his uncle down."
"It takes a special kind of kid to overcome an injury like that," said Ballou. "I don't think he'll ever do what it takes to be 100%.
Sometimes it sounded as if they were talking about a pro player making $1 million a year with a contractual obligation to play. Not an 18-year-old kid playing for his high school team who, To be here at all had overcome abandonment by his mother and foster homes and learning disabilities. LV understood the team's interest, but he also understood the needs of his nephew as well as himself. They weren't in this so that Booby could be a dutiful substitute coming off the bench to give Comer or Billingsley a rest. There was no ticket to the promised land in doing that.
I'd rather hold him out and let him take his chances in college. If it wasn't the football season, it would be much easier, he said in the silence of the locker room. But LV knew how much emotion and energy had been wrapped into Booby's senior year, how so much of Booby's life, as well as his own, seemed to hinge on it. How long had they waited? LV gave one of his little laughs and lowered his palm until it was about 4 feet from the ground. Ever since he was right there. He decided to let him continue.
Booby played sparingly the following week in a 48-2 win over Dallas Jesuit that upped Permian's record to 6-1. He ran the ball 5 times for 14 yards and seemed even more tentative than he had against Abilene High. He broke to the right on one carry, but had no acceleration at all and was easily tackled for no gain. He rumbled for 5 yards on another play, but went down before taking a hit. The next Friday night, Permian met the Cooper Cougars in Abilene. On the second play of the game, Comer went 64 yards for a touchdown, his 7th of the season. Booby got his first carry of the game on the next series as a substitute and scored his first touchdown of the year on a 1-yard dive. He was livid after the play and threw the football at a Cooper player. Booby said the player had pulled his face mask and punched him in the face.
You're a senior. You got to be able to handle that, Gaines told him as he came to the sidelines.
I ain't gonna sit there unless somebody hit me in my damn face, said Booby as he walked to the player's bench, his voice strained and agitated.
Early in the fourth quarter, he scored another touchdown to make it 49-14. It was his last carry of the night, giving him 49 yards on 12 carries. As at the Abilene High game, there were times one could see tiny flashes of the old brilliance. But there were more moments of watching him try to cut upfield into freedom, only to fall helplessly to the ground. There were also times when his undisciplined running style seemed wilder than ever, as if he was frantically trying in a single carry to make up for an entire season that he knew was fleeing from him.
Part 2. There was hope now, and bit by bit, with each game, it had gotten brighter and brighter. It still seemed impossible half the time, but it was there, a glowing speck, like the last drop of the sun on the horizon. Could he cradle it? Could he catch it? Was it totally ridiculous to think of this skinny, earnest kid wearing the orange and white of Texas next year? Maybe so. Even Mike Winchell wondered how he could possibly compete with the studs that he read about over and over in the worn pages of Texas Football Magazine. Guys from Hurst Bell and Denison and Langham Creek, who were taller and faster and stronger. Guys with discreet half-smiles on their faces, who always looked as if there wasn't a thing in the world that could ever get to them or rattle them. Mike himself had a wonderful smile, but it suggested warmth and innocence, not serene self-confidence in the face of all challenges. That was kind of an oops, was the way he described his entrance into the world. Sometimes he half-jokingly suggested that he should have gotten out of football back in Pop Warner, when he was at the top of his game. And yet, on days when he was feeling good about himself and everything just seemed to click, he knew he threw the ball with a special gift. The Abilene Cooper game had been like that. It was all so wonderfully, effortlessly easy. He already had had several great games, the opener against El Paso Austin, the one against Midland High, but this was his greatest. Midway in the first quarter, when he had seen the Cooper cornerback go into motion before the play started, he knew they were going to be in man-to-man. He looked for flanker Robert Brown down the right sideline and threw the ball cross-field on a dime, about 40 yards. Brown caught it in stride for a 62-yard touchdown. In the second quarter, he lined up and saw the Cooper secondary once again out of kilter. They were giving Brown too much cushion, laying off him 6 or 7 yards. Once again, he won the chess match and laid the ball in for a 19-yard touchdown. Still in the same quarter, he lined up over center and saw Cooper in one-on-one coverage against Lloyd Hill. That was more idiotic than giving Robert Brown a 7-yard cushion. The play immediately formed in his mind. Hill ran a fly pattern, and Winchell hit him with a 45-yard touchdown. Still in the same quarter, he backpedaled, saw Robert Brown break free, and threw another touchdown pass. This one good for 18 yards. By the time the first half ended, Winchell had thrown 9 passes. 5 had been incomplete. The other 4 had been for touchdowns. He didn't throw any more passes that night, but it hardly mattered. Through the first 8 games of the season, he had thrown for 17 touchdowns. Assuming Permian got into the playoffs, which seemed automatic at that point, he was destined to break the single-season record for most touchdown passes. Michael has had so many strikes against him and has struggled so hard. You just want to see him succeed, said Deborah Hargis, a social studies and history teacher at Permian. There just aren't a lot of good kids, and he's a good kid. Like many who met him, she became both intrigued and enchanted with him. She saw something rare there, and when she thought of him, a particular image often came floating back to her. The year before, when he had been in her history class, they had held a beautiful baby contest. Mike brought in a picture of himself, but it wasn't one of those smiling from ear-to-ear shots taken at Sears or Penny's. Mike had never lived a life like that. Instead, he was holding a piece of gum while a single tear, like the wispy trail of a jet, fell down his cheek. Mike explained that he was crying because he had never seen a camera before and thought it was a gun. Hargis always remembered that picture and the softness of those brown eyes, as Mike apparently thought he would be shot the second the shutter button clicked. She loved the way he was with children, particularly those who worshipped him and came to the school pep rallies wearing a jersey with his number 20 on it. She loved the relationship he had with his grandmother, how he delighted in her and always watched out for her. She loved the way he was a klutz off the field despite his enormous athletic abilities, how he invariably spilled food on himself when he went out to eat, or how, when he got up from his desk in class one day, he knocked it over. There were times when a dark cloud descended over him, making him virtually silent. His face became filled with a look of sad, aching brooding, as if he was thinking about something that only he could understand and somehow resolve. But there were other times when he became alive and animated, like a child gingerly touching the edge of the ocean before plunging in, displaying a curiosity unique among kids who lived in Odessa. New York, Philadelphia, the towering cities of the East beckoned to him with the exoticism of stories by Kipling, and he wanted to know about them, to see if the things he had read in magazines and saw on television were true. Were there muggers on every corner? Was there really a mafia? The absolute lack of guile in his voice as he wondered about places that seemed to exist in a universe separate from the one he occupied in Odessa. The twinkle of a smile spreading over the flat contours of his face made it easy to see why his favorite book, outside of the sports autobiographies he had read of Jim McMahon and Ken Stabler and Reggie Jackson, was Huckleberry Finn. Floating on a raft down the Mississippi to one mysterious place after another with nothing else around except trees and water, it beckoned to him. "I could stand to do that, go down the river," he said. As he probed and pawed about worlds so different from his own, something in his own life would suddenly hit him. The time he had gone deer hunting and had one in his sights, but couldn't bring himself to shoot it. Another time, when he had camped out near the Devil's River down around Del Rio, fishing trips on the Pecos, where he and a friend went river rafting on old tables they had found. The road trip with his brother to the state high school football championship between Mart and Shiner. He talked for a minute, or maybe two, or maybe even five, as if something inside him had been punctured, had been unleashed and come alive again. And then, abruptly, the torrent stopped and his face once again regained its brooding stare. Hargis knew there were days when it was best to leave Mike alone, when he seemed impervious to the emotional gestures of anyone. But there were also days when her poking and prodding led to a small foothold inside him, a tiny ray of light inside an intricate cavern with more depth than anyone could possibly have realized. She desperately wanted him to make it, as did everyone else who had ever met him and become aware of some of the tidbits of his past. The death of Billy, the way he refused to let virtually anyone inside his home, the way he had raised himself. As Booby's season became a sad and sour struggle, Mike Winchell's only continued to rise. As Booby tried to find the natural rhythm of the year before, Mike edged closer and closer to a dream he had quietly harbored for much of his life. As they headed into the ultimate showdown against Midland Lee, they were two opposites, one plunging so fast he could barely hold on anymore, the other soaring beyond all expectations. Led by Winchell, Permian trampled the Cooper Cougars 56-14 to push its record to 7-1. Everywhere you looked that night, you saw a star. Winchell at quarterback, Comer at fullback, Hill at split end, Brown at flanker, Christian at middle linebacker, Chavez at tight end, a team so damn good it hadn't missed a single beat when Booby had wrecked his knee and went on without him, as if he had never been there. And every fan couldn't help but believe that the following week's game would be little more than a continuation of the Cooper obliteration, only 1,000 times more sweet. It was hard to get too worked up over Abilene and the Cooper Cougars. They didn't look down their noses and act as if Odessa was some sort of primeval desert wilderness with people whose intellectual capacity fell somewhere between that of the Goths and the Visigoths. No, there wasn't any reason in the world to hold a grudge against Abilene. But the same couldn't be said for Midland, which held a unique place in the hearts of almost every Odessan. Even the most liberal ones who had spent a lifetime fighting racial and social injustice and who cherished the notion of open-mindedness drew the line at the Midland border. "Texans everywhere except Midland are tolerant of each other," said Odessa attorney Michael McLeish, still smarting from the time he had gone as a kid to a party in Midland over at the country club and walked around in a bow tie that began to feel as big as a ski jump while everyone else looked so cool and casual. "Midland is a principality. I don't like people from Midland. They don't like us, and we don't like them. I just can't stand those bastards, and they feel the same way about us." Push for the Playoffs. Chapter 11. Sisters. Part 1. Logically, they should have been united, not only by the common bond of oil that had kept them in clothes for 60 years, but by the bonds of loneliness. As your car fought its way across West Texas along Interstate 20 in the blistering heat, and it felt as though you had been in the state for a week and had another week to go before you saw any sign of human life, they suddenly rose out of the emptiness like territorial forts. There was Midland, with its improbably tall buildings, glassy and shimmering in the sun like misplaced tanning reflectors. 15 miles to the west, there was Odessa, sprawling and oozing. Its most striking feature, the fenced-off fields with row after row of oil field equipment that looked like rusty military weapons from a once great war. It seemed natural that they needed each other, as all good sister cities should, but instead They had spent most of their histories trying to prove just the opposite. Midland was the fair-haired, goody-goody one, always doing the right thing, never a